My recommendation is show up to class, whether you're better than everyone or, you know, just starting. And I, like I said, I feel like there's the ego thing because I feel like when you put somebody out in the street, they should have a certain level of toughness, all that. And then when you don't feel like you are, or you have to prove it, how tough you are on a mat with, you know, some people who may really be super tough, drop it all, drop the egos, you know, just get in there, do it. It'll save your life. Maybe something that you learn and your experience on the mat that you pass along to a friend that's on the job could save their life.
Hey guys, if you missed out on the last conference in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't want to miss out on the next one. It's April 28th through May 3rd, Orlando, Florida, the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center. You made a mistake missing the last one. You don't want that to happen again on this one. 5 days of some of the best training you're ever going to experience packed into one event. We have an early bird special right now, $50 off. Use 24 early bird on our website, streetcop.com. Look for the conference, click the link, register today. If you want to get significantly better at this profession in 5 days, don't dare miss out on the 2024 Street Cop Conference. 111, 110.
Street Cop.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Benino, and I probably should have told Phil Mitlarice that we were going to just go and just go from wherever, because he's sitting here probably thinking we didn't discuss anything about the show before we started. But me and Phil have already been chopping it up a little bit, and I'll let Phil give you a little context of who he is. We were put together by a mutual friend, and it's really cool shit. Glad to have Phil here. Phil's got a good story. Phil, I appreciate you taking a ride over from the Philly area.
Yeah, it's easy.
I'm glad to see that you aren't shot, which is awesome.
No.
Phil, tell us about you, man.
So I grew up in Philadelphia. Like I was telling you, I grew up in a interesting family. I grew up around all fighters my whole life. Going back to my great-grandfather, my dad, and now me and my brother have been involved in jiu-jitsu since I was a little kid. So I met the Gracies when I was about 8, I think. And then I never stopped. So 47 now, and just, you know, I'm still crazy about it.
So how often are you training? Have you trained competitively? And
yeah, so rewind, you know, like my 20s and even early 30s. I trained 7 days a week, sometimes twice, three times a day. I was crazy. So I would train in jiu-jitsu or wrestling or, you know, some sort of martial art and, you know, compete. The scene back then was not, what it is today. You know, competitors today, they're actually making money for matches. I made zero for, I always say like, I'm lightly jealous of all the major competitors these days because, you know, they're all making a living, which is great. You know, I had a, always had a, you know, secondary job or a backup. And what I was telling you, I just recently exited a digital company. So I was involved in digital marketing, either as a consultant or a business owner for more than 20 years. So that was my backup gig that always supported my passion gig, which is, you know, owning jiu-jitsu schools and, you know, dabbling in other products as well. So I came from an entrepreneurial slash fighting family. It was an interesting family.
Yeah, it's interesting, dude. Yeah. What kind of fighting did your grandparents and great-grandfather and father
so
do?
So they say it was like a gentleman's boxing. You know those images that you see? Well, you know, going back to Italy, my great-grandfather was, you know, tough dude and came here. And then my grandfather and then my dad. And then, like, learning jiu-jitsu was interesting for me because everyone in my family, they were strikers, right? And, you know, I learned jiu-jitsu, spent a couple years in there, and I was able to, like, take my uncles down, you know, and get them on the floor and mount them and, you know, not hit them, but just show control.
Yeah.
So I knew that there was something else out there besides just boxing or using your hands, you know? And, yeah, the rest is history. From there, I just fell in love with it, and, you know, I traveled out to California. I was all over the world for grappling because, let's just say early 90s, I was in high school still, and I just couldn't wait to get out of high school because I knew I was going to get on a plane and go places and learn and then bring it back to Philadelphia. That was kind of my mission. And I went to the Gracie Academy in Torrance, California. It was, you know, biggest and best, and Elio Gracie was there, and Orion Gracie, Hoist Gracie. So that's where I would go, like in the 90s, back and forth. My direct instructor is Helson Gracie. So he's Hoist's older brother. And he's known as like the champion of the family. And I lived with him in Hawaii and, you know, just kind of poked around the world and, you know, checked out all the grappling. I lived in India because I also, when I was a child, I also started yoga and I still do it today. Like I still do jiu-jitsu. And yeah, I lived in India. I wrestled there with the Indians and
Oh, shit. Yeah,
it's interesting. They wrestle in like red clay. So for, you know, collectively 6 months of my life, I was there, lived in Thailand, trained Muay Thai. Yeah. So I kind of popped around a bunch of different places to, you know, just make sure we're doing the best thing before I ever opened anything. So I opened my studio, Balance Studios. It's going to be 21 years in October. We opened that and I brought jiu-jitsu, some striking and yoga together in one spot. And, you know, it started small with one gym. We branched out here in Philadelphia. There's like three locations. And then around the planet, over 50 affiliates now. So they're affiliated. So there are black belts or brown belts went out there and opened something where we partnered or something like that.
Obviously, you were in high school in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not far. Lawrenceville.
Oh, really? Jersey.
Yeah. I went to Lawrence High.
Oh, were you born in Jersey too?
No, I went to high school there, just here. Yeah.
How'd you end up doing that?
I used to summer here, hang out with my grandparents, and I met all the kids, and then high school was going to start for me there, and I really didn't want to go, and I ended up going here. Yeah.
Your parents let you come over to the side with your grandparents?
Mm-hmm.
That's super cool, man.
Yeah.
How was your relationship with your grandparents?
Oh, terrific. Yeah. They're like second parents, obviously.
Still alive?
My grandmother's still alive. She's 97.
Wow, yeah. I was going to say, dude.
Yeah, my grandfather passed away, but my grandma, yeah, she's still around and still hilarious.
No shit. Yeah. Is she funny still?
Yeah, my grandmother's hilarious, yeah.
I have an uncle turning 99 next month.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, and he's like living on his own, still drives.
Wow.
World War II veteran, D-Day Normandy, first wave, three tours in Germany. Amazing dude.
Huh.
So in high school, you go to Lawrenceville.
Lawrence High, sorry. Yeah, not the...
Right, go to Lawrence High School. What are you like in high school? Do people know what your history is as far as being a fighter?
Yeah, not many people knew jiu-jitsu then. You have to remember, 93, the UFC came out. So I remember in school. When did I graduate? I graduated in 93, sorry. So that's when I graduated.
I remember it coming out. I remember seeing it as a kid at my grandmother's house, coming out on pay-per-view and being advertised in the early 90s.
Yeah, so I had been training and they knew I knew something. I was like tested too. First 2 weeks of school, I was like the city kid that came in, and I guess there was a kid there who was like a tough guy, and he like shouldered me in the hallway, and he was like, you know, we're fighting at 3 o'clock. I was like, oh, cool, okay, yeah.
Did you fight him?
Oh yeah, I fought him. But
did you kick his ass?
Yeah, I hit him. He didn't. Yeah. So I grew up throwing my hands.
Right.
So that's all I really had to do. I hit him one time, and then you know.
That was it. People knew from that point forward.
They kind of knew something. And then a lot of, you know, then my friends would play around, like grapple with me. And I also worked out with some of the kids that were wrestlers. And I didn't wrestle on the high school team, but I was friends with all the wrestlers because I would like work out with them. Like, how does this kid know this? Because I was a boy that trained with men. I was never in a kid's class. That's how early I started. You know, my brother and I, and there was only a handful of people on the East Coast that started jiu-jitsu.
Right.
Very small. So it was like 11 of us. That's where it started. And pretty much, unless I'm completely mistaken, I've never heard otherwise, but jiu-jitsu in the East Coast kind of started in Philly. Steve Maxwell, he opened up a gym.
I'm hearing the Jersey, Philly, a little bit of New York.
And it came to Jersey. Yeah. Yeah.
Ricardo's Almeida story is that, I guess, Enzo Gracie. Is that right?
Enzo
Gracie. Took him as a street kid from Brazil and brought him to Manhattan. And then they kind of all migrated over to Jersey.
Yeah, I think he took over the gym that I used to teach in when I was here. I used to teach in, what was the name of that gym? Man, I forget the name of the gym, but I believe that Ricardo went in right after me. I moved back to Philly, and I believe he started like his gym and his...
He's a good dude,
yeah,
man.
Nice guy.
Real nice guy.
Yeah, tough guys that come out of that gym and, you know.
He's got all the love in the world for Frankie Edgar.
No, he's the best. Frankie's the best.
Yeah, so he's like Ricardo.
Gentleman,
like, I just knew he
toughest
was,
dude ever.
Yeah, he's a jet, bro. He's like the nicest fucking guy. It's funny because like most jiu-jitsu guys are the nicest guys, but my kids go and train at Dante's gym, right? So for me now, when I see a guy who's wearing flip-flops and walking in somewhere,
yeah,
and I'm like,
him.
Oh, this is a bad dude, yeah. Right? If you're wearing flip-flops.
It's the truth.
I know, flip-flops and carrying a gym bag, bro. You're that's a fighter.
Yeah, my friend came to train with us not too long ago. He's a good black belt, and I was like, man, just watch the young guys. I'm like, he's 41 now. He's very good at jiu-jitsu. I was like, watch the young guys. And I was like, watch these kids, man. They're going to take their glasses off, put them down, be like, would you like to roll, sir? You know, like very respectful, but they're little monsters, you know?
Yeah, dude.
And he went with one of our guys. He's just, the kid got it, you know, took advantage of him. The kid trains every single day, but he's like very thin and got the flip flops and wears glasses. And I love that stuff.
They got some bad dudes at that gym. I've watched them roll. They are.
My gym?
At
Ricardo's. Yeah.
I'm not in the circuit. I bring a 9 and a 7-year-old. I'm sorry, a 7 and a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
To the gym, so I get to watch the kids.
They're the baddest ones.
They're a lot of fun to watch. Actually, I like the next level up because they've gotten really good. So, like the I think they got a, if it's an 8-year-old class, the next one up 8 to 10.
Like
maybe.
The ones that start at 4.
So we start at 5 there.
No. I'm saying I start at 8, 9. You see the kids that start at birth now. Dad's a black belt, play with them a little bit. They go into a class, play a little bit. By the time they're 8, they're like little black belts, but in a little miniature body. Pretty incredible. That's what I'm saying.
Rich Bruno is an instructor for our company. He's a firearms instructor, and his kid goes there too. That's where I hang out with Rich. And I was watching his kid go the other day, and his kid's fast.
Yeah.
He's fast. He's moving along quickly. I mean, he's still figuring out. I think he's 8 years old, 8 or 9. But he's fast. He's quick. I'm like, man, Rich, he's fast. He's like, yeah, he's pretty good. He's been doing it. He's a gray belt.
Yeah.
He's been doing it for a little bit.
I watch my nephew. So my cousin, Frank Ambriefe, he was the law enforcement. And he was, man, I think he was the first person to bring jiu-jitsu to Northeast Philly. Right? He used to teach cops first 30-something years ago. Just got a couple, you know, law enforcement together, show some jiu-jitsu. Comes from a wrestling background, too. So he's my partner I have a gym in Northeast Philly too. He's my partner there. His son, right? So Frank Ambriefe is he's grappling 40 years, let's say, right? All that knowledge into his kid. He wrestles and he's, you know, he's in these big camps and stuff like that. The kid is lightning speed. I sit back, he can walk across the mat on his hands, and these kids are amazing. He's 7 now.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. But he can lower his level and fire in like lightning. I think I get a kick out of that stuff. You know,
yeah.
Just seeing this like natural aptitude with grappling or any, you know, even the striking arts too.
My kids are going about a year, so they're not super impressive yet. But I have seen a lot of improvement. They seem to be getting things a little bit more. It's starting to click now.
Yeah.
A little bit. So when did you land back in Jersey or essentially Philadelphia?
Yeah. So let's think. So went to high school here. Like I said, got tested a couple times, but I did. See, jiu-jitsu is cool. I can do it in a way I can throw you without smashing you. I can put you down and get you in a hold and be like, you believe it? And you're like, I don't have to squeeze it. So that's what happened to me in high school. But everybody was cool. I actually went out for the wrestling team. So I think my sophomore year, everybody's telling me, you got to do it. You got to do it. I was like, okay, I'll try out. And then I worked out with, you know, I was a child, but I was like, these people are children that I'm rolling with because I was used to going with giant adult males that are trying to kill me, you know, like
right.
They were never nice to me. And I did well with a couple of the kids. And then the coach there, who I knew, he was a gym teacher too. He was a coach of the wrestling team. He was like, bring Jason over to go with him. He was like the senior that was jacked. He was like head of, you know, he was an assistant coach also. Wrestled with him and I did a little trip move, put him down. And it's actually funny, like, I didn't know about I didn't know the point of wrestling on the ground, essentially. The pin, yeah. Hold, I was like, I didn't get it. Guy had his arm up, so I put him in an arm bar, but I knew not to arm bar somebody in wrestling. I just held it, but it was like a technical pin in wrestling. This guy went bananas.
He's pissed.
He got up, he's like, yo, you and me, we're fighting. Like, he was, yeah, got in my face, started, like, yelling. They split it up, it was heated. And
his ego couldn't handle it.
No, and I wasn't being disrespectful, I just was doing the stuff, you know, I was just doing what I thought I was supposed to be doing. He got mad, pushed, you know, he was ready to fight again. I mean, honestly, I was ready to fight him. I was like, could we do this in school?
That's great.
You know, the gym teacher, the coach had to go with this guy. They were like, McLaurice is not getting on. So I didn't get on the team, but I literally worked out every single day. We had this little auxiliary gym in Lawrenceville. And it was like Matt. I just work out after school where I worked out with a lot of my friends. I taught them as much as I could. And then I would go back to Philly on the weekend. So I'd train like Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, and then go back to school. That's all I pretty much did during high school. And then when I went back to Philly, I prepared to travel, you know. So here's another thing you should know. When I was 17, I was going to graduate a little early, 93. That January 93, I got in a car wreck. Pretty nasty one. Nothing to the point where I'm, you know, there's disability, but broke my hips, broke my neck.
Wow.
Yeah, broke everything, you know, like this little jiu-jitsu kid and now folded up and in pretty bad shape. So I had I recovered that year, but I don't know. It was one of those injuries where I was on my back. There was no pins, no cast, nothing like that. They were just like, stay still and you'll be okay. I had to lay still and just, you know, get myself through the day, like looking up at the ceiling.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, you know, thankfully I had some yoga training because I would do like breathing exercises to keep myself sane. Think, read, watch tapes. And I say tapes, probably half the people out there don't know what I'm talking about.
All right.
VHS tapes of jujitsu stuff. Like my training partners were cool enough to send some stuff out. And, you know, how to get myself through that one. So during that period of time, let's say it was about 7 months before I got up on my feet. I was no good. I had this plan in my mind. I was like, you know what? This whole like immediately go to college thing and, you know, go through 4 years, get a job in that. And then putting jujitsu, which I had a feeling it would be something because it was nothing then, right? The UFC had just happened. Let me remember how that happened.
I don't think it was called the UFC either, right?
Yeah, it was Ultimate Fighting Championship.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay, Ultimate Fighting.
Yeah, we were there.
What was it called before that?
Nothing. Yeah, it was Horian Gracie. So it was one of our instructors. He invented the UFC.
He was getting banned all over the place,
everywhere,
right?
Everywhere.
Except but, Vegas, right?
Well, no, Denver. So you fast forward, I get better, right? And I just make this declaration, like, I'm going to go full force into jujitsu and yoga. I'm not doing anything else, you know? I'm going to, you know, I was an avid reader at that point. I already did all that stuff. So I'm
interesting
like, Weird kid. Yeah, a lot of
interesting. Not the typical road that people go down at all.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. The car accident knocks some sense into you, you know? And it makes you feel
vulnerable.
Part one, lucky, you know, knock on wood, I wasn't disabled. There are a lot of people in a lot worse situations and a lot, you know, their physicalities, you know, I still move around every day and train jiu-jitsu, feel pain from this accident still. Oh yeah. But it's nothing compared to what some other people have experienced. So I don't try to, you know, use it as a boohoo thing. You know, it's really what happened, but it was like a pause in my life to analyzed. I was 17. So I was like, what am I doing with the rest of this thing? So I said, I'm going to go full force into this thing. And then the UFC, we go out there, watch Hoist, you know, do his thing and change the world.
What were you thinking when you were watching that shit?
I had seen and been involved in street fights, right? You know, growing up in Philly, like, you know, if you were never in a street fight, you were weird, you know, like yeah. At that point, now it's the opposite. And the very first fight, I don't know if you remember it, a kickboxer versus a...
Muay Thai.
No.
Not Muay Thai.
It was a Hawaiian guy. So I'm not sure what he did, but he looked like he tried to grapple and he got his face kicked and his tooth flew out, literally went like right out of the ring. And I was like, "Dad, this is the realest thing you can possibly imagine. You know, this is the... like, it went over a street fight because they're allowing it. They're going to keep it going. Street fight could last minutes. That's going to last until someone's dead.
Right.
Pretty much the UFC, there were very few rules in the beginning. And I was like, wow. You know, I shifted right there too after I saw that fight. And then I watched the other ones. There was a part of me, I'm like, is this a sport? You know, like, guy got held on the ground, got his head bashed in with an elbow. I feel like it went, in today's standards, they all went way too far. You know, damage to the athlete. We don't want that.
Right.
But it was exciting and it made jiu-jitsu the most notable thing around. So you talk about high school, no one knew what I was talking about or what I was doing. I had to explain like this thing, jiu-jitsu, there are these Brazilian guys, they're Gracie. I had to tell that story 200 times a day. And then after the UFC, no need. Everybody knew. So, it was kind of cool. And then, like I said, I lived with those guys, most of the Gracies and, competed, went through a teacher training with Elio Gracie. So he's, you know, He was the grandmaster of jiu-jitsu, invented a lot of what we do today and the systems that we use not only for civilians, but for law enforcement. So I was involved in all that stuff. And funny enough, so we teach law enforcement classes, you know, it was called Grapple 100 years ago. Now it's the Combatives, the Gracie Combatives. So I knew all this stuff. I knew how to, like, you know, take a gun away, hold someone down, put the cuffs on. I could do all that stuff when I was 16.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. My uncle was the chief of police in Lawrenceville.
No shit.
Seabridge. So William Seabridge. So he brought me in one day. He was like, show these young guys. It's all police officers, you know, with the fake guns and stuff like that. Some moves in there. And everyone was like this. And, you know, like, this is a kid. What does this kid have? You know? And then we talked about the gun and went, took it right out of his hand. And then another cop, like, we're talking to him. I just clinched him. There's a little move you can do to take it right out of the holster. And they're like, all right. Because what I would do is I would show the problem and then offer a solution later. I was like, you know, when I was in my 20s, I used to travel and teach law enforcement.
That's awesome.
That's how I would present it, because I knew how to win a crowd over to understand, like, you know, this is why you need it. You know, you definitely need this stuff to retain your weapon, to actually use it properly, to, you know, not have to use it. So you can use your hands and your weight and jiu-jitsu abilities instead of, you know, escalating.
It's amazing the state of affairs we're in and the access we have to such training. And yet still, I would argue 95% of cops have no training in the physical combative
sense.
Yeah,
I say, so, you know, the base DT manuals that I've seen do not address the most important stuff. Now, on the other side, I've seen some that have, like, some terrific jiu-jitsu, especially, like, the basics, the fundamentals, and that's what you need. You only need about a year of jiu-jitsu fundamentals to really just get it. Anybody on the planet, just about a year to understand the fundamentals, what to do, what not to do. Kind of feel like anything within that, like, year, 2 year mark, anything above and beyond that becomes sportive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go in the gym, work out with somebody else, you're playing a game. The other, you know, the first bit of it is pure self-defense. Like, you know, like I said, retaining the weapon, angling your body properly, just understanding how to operate properly on the street when there's no mat. So that's the big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In an uncontrolled environment.
Uncontrolled, unknown. Yeah.
It's wild to me. And I know that some people have said, well, we don't have a gym close to us. And that's few and far between. I, in my mind, can't figure out how there are cops out there that have access to these places and still don't go.
Right.
And I think it just comes down to the point that they think it's not going to happen to them.
Yeah.
And so if we could ask those who it happened to, did you think that way? They'll say, yeah, we have men and women on the show who suffered serious injury in the line of duty. And we get to hear from them about what it was like. And I actually thought about this morning. I say that all the time, but it's true. I have like a million thoughts a day. When these men and women are shot, laying there ready to die, they start having regrets immediately. Like, as you're dying, that's what they told us they go through. They're just like, I didn't get to do that. I didn't get to do this. I never said I'm sorry to this person. I should have not done. All these things start going through your head as you're laying there dying. What didn't I do with my life? But why put yourself through that situation if you have access to things that can inherently make you not being in a situation like that?
Right.
It's wild to me. I don't get it. And there's only a hand. I mean, if you had a 200-man police department, I bet you there's 10 guys that train at the whole place and girls as well.
I think it's better these days because what I've seen in different departments. So in Philly, federal, local, some of the federal guys train with us, and they go, hey, can you give me enough to go back? And just start a little group themselves.
Yeah, right.
Not a civilian, you know. They're in there teaching as much as they can, get the people together. It's a good idea to get, you know, like a good black belt that understands street, not just the sport things. Someone who understands the street. That's why I like the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu style, because it addresses punches, kicks, slams, headbutts, things like that. To come in, like get a good black belt to come in every once in a while, fix stuff up, you know. And that's what I'm seeing happen right now. And it's hard because you want to make it nationwide, every department. It's hard. And then you think about who trains at gyms, who actually goes, let's say civilians, who goes. the majority of people that come through my gym don't stay with it. That's the majority, you know. I had thousands of people come through my gym and sign up every year. We only have, you know, 100 stay. And I think it's kind of the same way. So you can get turned off to it if it's presented a certain way or if you have to do something. And there's that hierarchy too. So it could be your superior is in your class and you know more jiu-jitsu than your so, you know, just because you have a superior position in law enforcement doesn't mean you have a superior position in, you know, you're not automatically a black belt.
Right.
I think there's an issue there. And when that is handled, you know, like, is the hierarchy, no one's bowing down. You know, that's what I've seen. You know, you tap out your boss, you know, like,
yeah,
things are funny at work.
Yeah.
So once that is handled somehow, I don't know how, but, you know.
I like to think that the ego's not hurt by these bosses.
Yeah.
Because I would think that, I think collectively, for the most part, even if they're a bad boss, everybody in law enforcement appreciates the man or woman who knows how to handle themselves.
Right. I think so too.
So, you know, I would imagine if a boss has that much of an ego, they're probably not even getting on the mat at some point. They're probably just not going to get on the mat.
I was in, you know, Fletsy in Georgia?
I went there.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay. So I taught there and, but I was teaching instructors, you know, so it's like 100 and something instructors in the class. Right. And, there were also, I believe, some military there doing something. I'm not sure what. But a couple guys came, and they were in, like, different clothes, cargo pants. They were just in different gear, and they looked differently, too. They were big dudes. And one guy tested me. He was just like, what if this? What if that? I was like, well, I have this curriculum, and I'm just going, you know, by the numbers right now. I can get to that later. Kept pushing. So I said, all right, lay down. Let me show you. He was like, I was just getting the hand in a cuff position via, you know, the Kimura lock.
Okay. Yeah.
So you do it without breaking the arm, but you can get it behind the back. And then I was talking about it, and this guy puts his hand in his pocket, tries to one-up me, pulls a blade out. He didn't unlock the blade. It was clipped into his cargo shorts. Kind of crazy. And then my mind, I just went, boom, took his arm in the real Kimura armbar, and I smacked the knife about like 50 feet away. It slid down the whole mat in such a dramatic fashion. Everybody was like, and I won him over. This guy was like, thank you so much. I love it. So I had to win that guy over. And then talking, like, I was the guy teaching the class. He loved me all of a sudden. Like, he was my best buddy. And then he was like, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And I was just like with these guys for about an hour and a half after. They were showing me moves. They were showing me things that they deal with close quarters with this, you know, long gun, short gun. And then what I wanted to, I dropped all the 6-degree black belt stuff. I drop all that with law enforcement. That doesn't matter, right? Because I'm not on the street every day. I'm not, you know, I'm on a mat more than I'm on concrete. But they broke down a lot of scenarios for me that I was able to help later as an advisor. So that's what I was saying. Like, if you do have the boss, they drop that for a second to get proper information from collectively from who's there. I think that's the way to be, you know, like me, I'm around some of the best wrestlers, Olympic level, some of them, the best kickbox. I've never been around or had the luxury of someone who sucked. Always the best around me. And I'm very fortunate. I pick their brains all the time. More than they ask me for stuff, I'm like, show me that thing. What did you just do? You know, I want to see some wrestling. That's what I'm doing now. Like, I'm lightly obsessed with different areas of wrestling at a, you know, I'm 47 now. I shouldn't be, but, you know, technical wrestling. But I just think that, you know, when you have the ego, it puts up a barrier and a wall to education. It's not good. And when there's life and death, when it's a life and death situation, I just shouldn't even be a consideration. I don't know. Meaning these moves that you learn can save someone's life, and they have.
You have no doubt.
Yeah.
It's funny because as you're talking about these egos and...
No, it's not everyone.
Yeah, no.
No, yeah, don't get me wrong. I've seen a lot of collaboration. I mean, one of the ways I met you is through Billy Mazur.
Mm-hmm.
He's wonderful. He's been like, Billy's old school jiu-jitsu. He was with us in the 90s. Eric Scheffler, Rich Komar. So Rich, he was like the godfather of South Jersey, you know, the beach jiu-jitsu, that guy. But they're very humble. They want to learn. They want to absorb and then, you know, help law enforcement.
Billy's a good dude.
He's the greatest. He's the greatest.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Good looking son of a bitch, too.
Man, the hair.
Dude, he's fucking like, he's so goddamn good looking, it annoys me. Like, I hate when somebody's
we
that.
We hate you. Where are you?
Billy's a good dude. I just enjoy conversations with him a lot. But as you're talking, it reminds me of me. I am somebody who, at this point in my life, is very much into business, entrepreneurship, growth. I kind of get uncomfortable with the word entrepreneurship because
yeah, me too.
It makes me uncomfortable in the sense that when I hear somebody tell me they're going into real estate, because I actually was a successful realtor at one point in my career, it's like, oh God, like, you know, I'm thrilled when somebody does really well in an industry, especially in real estate. But I may have known one person in my entire life that actually said they're going to real estate and did good in real
estate. Right, right.
So when I say entrepreneurship, I think it's just this word that's thrown around. It's almost insulting to the industry,
yeah.
Which is fine. I want everybody to try things. I try to remind people of the context of how hard some of this stuff is. But when I go to these places and these meetups and I'm trying to learn more to essentially bring it back into this realm, and I say that for everybody listening because I really want to be the best for all of you that depend on me. I mean, this past weekend, I was quite social in the Jersey Shore scene. I don't mean out at nightclubs. I went to a boating event and then I brought my kids to the boardwalk, and it was really cool for a lot of people to come up to me and say, hey man, don't stop what you're doing. Like, you know, the content's so good. It's so important. So when people hear me say things like this, it's not about me. It's about I'm going there to try to get that information to bring it back. And it's always funny when I go to events that the people doing the worst have the biggest mouths and they're the biggest peacockers. I don't say anything anymore. I don't try to like level up. But what I do is I am in complete humility mode. I am, in my mind, the 3-year-old amongst men. And there are people who are 10 years younger than me who have eons of success beyond my success. And I sit there and just pick their brains, man. Like, tell me. They're like, no, you're doing a good thing, bro. I'm like, I know. But like, dude, tell me the thing. I want to learn from you. I know I'm 10 years older than you, but like, you are really, really talented. Just tell me some of the things. So like you're saying, like, what are some of the things you know about taekwondo and jujitsu and all these things to these other people that you're seeing, these kickboxers? I say to these guys, tell me things. I'm dying to know. Well, did you ever do this? No, I didn't. Yeah, this will work if you do it that way. Oh, that's really good, man. I never thought of that. It's so fucking smart. So it's funny how it assimilates back to, I think, the person and the subject matter they look to become great at.
Yeah.
How much humility do you have? How much are you willing to not peacock and just show up and listen, no matter how good you think you are? Because every time you think you're somebody who's the best, there's just somebody better than you.
I've been in that world lately.
Humble pie.
Well, yeah, I don't go in there trying to be anything. But I was telling you before, I had just recently retired from my side gig for 20 years, which was marketing. So
it's
exited a really great company, handed it to my business partners. And I literally did it to maintain my passion, which was the jiu-jitsu school. So at first, I didn't think they would work and, you know, they couldn't support a family. That's kind of what that represents. And then now I'm left with about 8 more hours of my day and I'm completely happy and working out during the day and that sort of thing.
But you earned it.
Earned it, yeah. But I'm still fascinated by marketing and what digital marketing also. And I always like to have a little something else on, you know, not on this side, but you know what I mean? Like, I like to keep myself active.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Like, I know the jiu-jitsu business in and out. We've been successful with the schools. And this is my recent thing, the Tatsu T.
When you develop skills and the kind of skills that you have, I'm not talking about your physical abilities and your combative skills.
Right.
I'm talking about
business and
your business skills. You can take those and reapply them anywhere and take anything like that drink that you've created over the past 5 years, that energy drink that I think is going to do well, and just infuse all that knowledge into this thing. So, and you know, it's what you see.
If we could rewind back to my childhood, I grew up in an entrepreneurial family too. So my dad would hit us dropping bombs every day, you know, like, we would hear it when we were kids. Nothing applied.
Was your father successful?
Yeah, very. He was good, but he didn't give us anything.
I get it.
Yeah, he was the dad that, like, you know, I got into Drexel University. I was all happy. He was like, congratulations, great job. I was like, you gonna help me out? He's like, you got it. And then he walked away. So he didn't pay for my college. I paid for everything. But he made us work. And when I say we, my brother Ricardo and I, he made us work for everything that we...
But what you guys got from him was invaluable. Yeah.
And I didn't realize that until I was an adult.
Dude, I mean, I'm sitting there explaining things to my kids at their young age for them to understand things. Like, they'll say, you know, maybe they'll make a comment about, like, our house. And I'll tell them, like, Daddy works really hard. Daddy did not grow up in a house that looks like this. Your father works a lot for you guys to have the things that you have. And dude, I don't live in the lap of luxury. It's a little bit more of a relaxed life financially, but it's not the lap of luxury, believe me. Still have yet to fly private. Looking forward to that one day. But the point I'm making, it's not a brag session. The point I'm making is what they'll get from me on what I know and how I see the world, and it's inherently different than 99% of people, is probably invaluable at that. Even if I didn't have a dollar to give them.
Right.
Just the knowledge. If somebody's fortunate enough to have somebody who's just stoic in their life, who's an influence on their life.
That was him.
That's great.
Yeah, dude. My pop was definitely like that.
My father was just the opposite. And, you know, not to his detriment, he's just a product of his environment. Yeah. So I remember my father doing things that you should never do when you're trying to teach your kids. And this is something my father would always do. My father bragged about everybody else's shit.
Huh.
This is his thing. And hey, did you see this guy? You see that car he got? Oh, my own. It's a what a car. You couldn't believe it. Like, it was never like you could have that too. It was always like essentially the message was you will never have it and just admire what other people have.
Yeah.
And then it took me a long time, probably till my early 30s, of like, you could actually have stuff like this. And I say that to share that with people listening to this podcast is everybody. Essentially, some guy just asked me a question recently. He's like, hey, what do I got to do to become wealthy? He's a cop. I said, first of all, unfortunately, you'll probably never be wealthy as a cop. But here's a good place to start. Work twice as much as everybody else in the beginning. Then you get smarter. So you don't have to work that many hours. You just work more intelligently. If that makes sense to you, you tell me if I'm wrong on this.
That's my whole
game. What I'm learning now is it's not about how many hours you put in. It's when you put hours in, are they smart?
Yeah.
I
was going to say that's what interested me in when I was a child, computers, because I understood the scalability of a business once you take it online, there's major scalability.
Mm-hmm.
With like a martial arts center like mine, you can only fit so many people. But if you have digital products that are infinitely scalable.
That's where we're going right now. What's in the works.
Yeah. So, you know, and I've seen the real numbers behind some major companies that we worked with, and I see what they sell. And I see how many, like some had digital products. Incredible.
So the product that we're doing right now is Street Cop University. It's a subscription-based product. We've revealed a little bit about it, and people seem to be very eager for it. But people have to understand that I personally have spent 10 years, almost 11 in this company, making sure everything we put out is not a piece of shit.
Mm.
So once this is ready and I look at it and say, this is going to be great. So when you pay your fee monthly or you buy the annual subscription for the year, when you get in there, you're going to feel like you stole it from me. Like, there's no way he's giving us this for this much money per month. Now, I've often said to people, if it had to be this cheap, it would have to have so many people that are members. We couldn't spread everybody around and give you this kind of product in the existing state or business state of this company. So we're working on it now, and I'm sure I have some stuff to work out with it, trying to do as much research as possible to reduce the likelihood of there being headaches with it.
Yeah. Well, if you ever need help,
that's the world
I worked in. I worked in membership-based businesses online. So the scale,
I will need your help.
That's what's
going to
funny.
You're going to regret saying that because now I'm going to
be like, hello.
I'll give you free t-shirts.
Yes, done deal. I work for shirts. I love it.
But yeah, hopefully I could do something for you on the other end of it. But yeah, dude, I'm not somebody who, and just know this, Phil, I always tell the mentors that I have, I'm part of a mastermind group and I just get together with these guys and they're all really good to me. They're all way ahead of me. But I always tell them, like, guys, your hour or 2 hours sitting down and helping me out, it goes from me to 10 other people because I'm mentoring other people who are below me And I don't mean that below me in like life.
Yeah, I get it.
Business is a road. And I think everybody's just at a different mile marker. So they're my mile marker. They're at mile marker one. You'll have to edit that too. Let me do it again. They're at mile marker one. I'm at mile marker 3.2. And maybe you're at mile marker 5.7. And then some of my friends are at mile marker 6.3.
Yeah.
We're all on the same road. We're all running the same race. We all have different skills. We all have different abilities. But I think that when you meet some people who are pure-blooded, purebred business people who are entrepreneurs, who are obsessed with the process, who this is what we love the most. Like, I love this. This is like my life. Like, I enjoy this the most. You know, dude, business is tough.
Yeah, I've been getting the same calls. Like, recently, too, more about marketing over anything else. And just, you know, I'll be on the phone with a friends of mine in so many different verticals, just, you know, giving advice. I'm not doing the work anymore, but I'm giving advice and kind of the pathway. And I try to push everyone to some sort of digital product. You know, I was like, you want, you know, I've seen major wealth produced via all things digital. So, like I said, I was fascinated as a kid with jiu-jitsu, but I see jiu-jitsu as an operating system, not just kicking someone's butt. It's a way of thinking. So you want to be efficient with your energy and time. And there's nothing better than a computer to scale things out that makes it, you know, perfectly efficient as a business. Things are selling while you sleep. And it's just, you know, you just have to. So the humility, I think, of business, why I think that's super important is because you listen. And if you're listening to markets, you're listening to needs and what people are asking for, and provide solutions. But if you're never listening, you know, that's why data is huge. So if you're looking to serve a certain market, you have to know that they're actually calling for you, you know? So it's like these data companies, there's one in the beverage, the Nielsen and Spins and what was previously called IRI. Data companies where you can get in there and you say, who likes matcha tea? And you can see everybody in the world who likes it, who buys it, how many they buy. So now we're able to do it in reverse. Like, let's say you had a product back in the day that like you loved it and you think everyone else will. You just think they will. You don't know that they're asking for it. Now you can do it in reverse. You could see the data and build a product behind it.
Right.
That's what's incredible. And that's where there are so many opportunities, you know. So you have people with talents in certain areas like cooking. Man, I could show you where the use of certain products are huge, that she can make a living based off of being aligned with these products. You know, they'll underwrite her, all her stuff. So interesting. Yeah.
That's, you know, I think there's a big unlock there. If anybody missed that, if you listen to Phil, he said you can find out what industries are doing the best and make a product for that industry.
Well, what people are buying, you can access this data. What they're buying, what they're searching online, what they're not just searching by keyword, but by keyword phrases, you know, like, where do I buy peppers? Well, create the answer online somehow. That's the easiest and most frictionless. You're going to win. So that's the major idea. That's my fascination. So that's why I had another whole nother life in marketing because of that fascination. So like when I first opened my gyms, I applied everything I knew from digital marketing right to the gyms. I was obsessed. I was like, I'm going to get 300 people here, there. And I was able to, you know, guide people to the right place where I wanted them. And then I realized I didn't want everyone. I didn't want every student. I don't want every personality. I want, you know, I want a bunch of good people with, you know, they don't have to be like-minded, but they have to be open-minded. So I started searching for those people. I just tweaked out, you know, what I did with the sites and my language and, you know, the messaging. It's interesting, right? Like, you may not want some clients. You have to pinpoint exactly who you want around you. If it's a, you know, my thing is an in-house thing. You copy and paste that to the digital world, selling your courses. You know, you want the right people still buying, and, you know, you identify your super fans from your regular fans, from your, you know, people just poking around in the freemium section.
Yeah.
You know?
And I see this with the intention of people understand. So my friend this weekend, who I was hanging out with, he's a high-level administrator at a police agency, and he asked me about money and the purpose and how they meet. And we're literally standing in the water at something called Floats and Boats here in New Jersey, having this conversation. People are just partying, and we're just talking drinking. Business, right? He wants to hear some of the business, right? So I said, you know, Bob, you got to understand something. The revenue is a lifeblood in the sense that, well, you may see it as I'm trying to procure more revenue, and that's where it ends, I'm revealing to you that I'm trying to procure more revenue so I can get to more cops.
Mm.
The more we procure, the more I can reinvest in this company, the more I can expand, and the more lives I can save and make better products. I'm not saying that I'm sitting here and I don't feel like I deserve to get paid anything, because I do get paid something. But you have to understand this is not a greed game. So it's this perfect mixture where you're trying to figure out the perfect mixture of compensation but purpose. You can't have one without the other. You know,
right.
It's like a conversation I had with my sister-in-law 8-9 years ago when she told me this. I'll never forget this conversation. I had like a 4-hour conversation with my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law. And they'll tell you to this day that was probably the most important conversation they ever got in their lives, because nobody ever told them about anything money related, credit, things like that. So I said to her, because she's very adamant.
Mm.
And so she came out with that teenage, money doesn't mean everything, blah, blah, blah. I don't need money to have a good life. And I'm like, okay, listen, what's a good life to you? She goes, well, I'd like to have a kid, maybe adopt a kid. I go, why just a kid? She's like, well, I don't know. Like, you can only have so many kids and adopt kids. I said, okay, but why? She goes, well, money's limiting. I said, if you made more money, don't you think you'd be able to provide for more children? And it just clicked for her. I'm like, if you made 3 times the amount of money you would make for one kid, that means you could adopt 3 more kids and have a bigger impact in the world. And so I don't mean to interject or bring Grant Cardone in this, but one of the messages he has in why you should make money is because you can't help anybody unless you have some.
I think it's the truth. I agree.
There's no question about it. You can give your time, but I mean, just a simple, Phil calls me, Phil's my friend. He says, hey, come over to my house and help me paint my house. I got a better idea, Phil. How about I help you with your business and I'll hire 3 people to paint your house for you? That's the gift I give to you. That's not some hotshot fancy, don't misunderstand what we're saying here. Is the point is you are able to help more people when you have more resources.
I'm a terrible painter anyway, so.
Yeah, dude, I just don't touch the paint.
Yeah.
And, you know, people don't know essentially my story and the things that I've done. Folks, I'm not here because I sat around and drank White Claws on the couch. I mean, I have gotten dirty on several occasions, still do. You know, bring you back to when we were loading and unloading the trucks for the conference. Andrew's sitting here listening to the conference. I mean, it just was what had to get done that day. And it probably wasn't the best use of my energy that day, but it had to get done.
Yeah.
So guys, you're just like, oh, it must be nice. Like, yeah, were you in the fucking heat moving, I don't know, 500 boxes, 700 boxes and equipment into an 18-wheeler with a couple guys that don't move shit typically, right? And just shuttling things back and forth in pickup trucks to the trailer parked out in the middle of goddamn nowhere. So, you know, there's days like that. People are like, oh, it's a beautiful summer day. I'm like, yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Mostly people see your highlights on Instagram. You don't see the...
I guess we're guilty of that too, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying yours, but I'm saying I think we all do that. You know, some people do it to a fault. And like, you don't see that their life is, you know, could be lightly terrible or more amazing than you think, than you see.
Yeah, I don't really try to portray some amazing life.
Yeah.
If anything, I try to keep it as real as possible. And I like to enjoy anything I have with everybody. I mean, the most...
Well, if you're not real in business, you quickly go out of business.
People catch on to it quick.
That's one of the biggest things. Like if you're in a fantasy world thinking that just money comes in because you posted something, so much more to it. And, you know, according to what sort of world you're in, you know, if you don't do the life things to, like you were saying, your lifeline is your revenue. And if you're not allocating that properly or, you know, reinvesting that or, that's it. That's why so many businesses go under,
because
it's like a fantasy world associated with a lot of business, you know? That's what you said, like entrepreneurial. Like I don't consider myself an entrepreneur because I've been in something for 30 years, jiu-jitsu. I just know it, you know? If I were a major entrepreneur, I would have, well, actually with this beverage, I am kind of jumping into a world that I'm a white belt in that world, but I'm a black belt in the business of like jiu-jitsu and marketing, you know? And I'm daring to go somewhere else. But, I often see that people ignore certain things in business, meaning that they don't think they're real, and you suffer the consequences then.
I'm
it's like a fantasy life, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm obsessed with business growth and the education behind business. I literally sit every morning, all morning long, on my drives, just listening, picking up on the nuggets. There's actually, right now, there's this Alex Hormozi video, and he deserves a shout out. And it's called, I think it's called Branding. If you look at, it's like an hour and 5 minutes long. So it's a branding one. I'm sure it's up to 500,000 views on it already. And it's not for everybody. You got to be in business.
Yeah. Or care about branding.
Actually,
you could be in business and
so it actually has nothing to do with the branding.
Yeah.
He starts the video out, if you'll know if you're in the right one. He says, I'm only going to talk about branding for 5 minutes because I actually don't think that that's going to help anybody here. And he goes into really very, very raw core concepts, maybe five significant concepts that you need to apply to your business right now. And I listen to it weekly to remind myself of what I need to be doing to make this thing better because I have a lot of eyes on me and a lot of people depending on every move that I make. And so, you know, I'm constantly trying to listen to learn. I just like being humbled. I really enjoy that. And I'm so open, but you can't be too vulnerable because then I think people, right now where I'm at, people are starting to see that there is something really big happening here with all humility. And so I've got to be a little guarded on who's coming into the circle to come in and be a part of it. Partnerships, ambassadors, things like that. People are starting to recognize that we are progressing and having a lot of momentum in the law enforcement community. It's a big community. It's not a small niche. There's, you know, essentially 700,000 cops in the country.
Yeah.
So it's not a small community, and we're trusted for a reason. I think the point is I'm not trying to ever disrupt or negotiate the trust that I've built for anything short term. So anytime I talk to anybody, I really got to really be very smart and thoughtful with where I'm going with this thing next. And dude, there's a lot of no's. A lot of just like, nah, it doesn't even feel right for me. So because it doesn't feel right, I'm just going to hold on to it. I would love to do something, but it doesn't feel right for me. And I just don't want it. That's if my gut's telling me don't do it, I'm just not going to do it. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, that is branding. They say essentially branding is what you feel in the pit of your stomach about a company. So those choices that you're making on that side are intentional for your company. You're trying to put the right feelings in people's bellies, you know, like I'm saying, your core about your product, which is great.
I'm actually have to go out to a company in Florida in a couple of weeks. That was actually the flight I was booking because we're looking at a partnership, really nice product so far. I really like the thing. A few people I know are involved in it. And I just said, look, I got to come down and see everything for a couple of days. And not that, I mean, who am I? But if you want me to sign on to it, I have to see it.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty
same way.
Confident.
I'm the same way.
I'm pretty confident what I see is what I think it is. And I just want to be able to make sure that if I'm out here conveying people a product that I'm confident that it's a good product and I'm also using the product as well.
Yeah.
So it's a good product. I like the idea of it. I like the guy who runs it. I like it so far. It's feeling really good. But we'll see. I have to go out and vet that as well. Hey guys, follow us on all social media platforms to include Instagram, Twitter, Facebook group. We have so much information going out every single day and we don't want you to miss out on any of that stuff. So check it out. Go give us a follow. How do you feel at 47, Phil?
47? Feel good. It's interesting being involved in the sport still, jiu-jitsu. I still train 5 days a week. I work out with the youngsters, you know.
Are you fifth degree black belt? Is that what it is?
6th degree black belt. My brother, Ricardo, he's 5th degree black belt. I don't feel so bad. I do yoga every day. And like I said, upon retiring from the marketing, I have more time in my day. So I've been kind of dipping into more health-related podcasts, YouTube videos, conversations with friends. Many of my friends own a lot of the companies we were talking about. So I was involved in CPG, like packaged goods. And I hovered around the better for you packaged goods, meaning like powders and, you know, matcha and drinks and like pre and post workout things, products. And now I'm like using them. So they're sending stuff out. I'm like, this is terrific. So instead of like choosing the bad food, you have the good food or the good, you know, products that you could take with you. You know, like I said, the different supplements. So I'm making better choices like that, literally within the past 3 weeks. And my brother, been about a little over three weeks now, we're just talking about like, man, the elbow is a little sore, knee's a little sore. Like we're a little bit more tight in areas that we're already super flexible, you know, from jujitsu and yoga. And is it age? What is it? So my brother, he cut out all gluten from his diet. Now, this is not the diet. I'm not a nutritionist, dietitian, anything like that. This is just what I'm doing right now. So it's just that's my disclaimer. And I was like, you know what? The heck with it. I'll do it with you. You know, so he just, you know, pulled out all the rice, breads, that sort of thing. His body, within about 4 days, he said, he could bend his knees properly. Swelling went down. Close your hands open. It's jujitsu, you know, like you're holding cloth. My preference is without the cloth, so you're like holding and gripping. It took about a week for me. My knees got less swollen. You know, it was just overuse. Hands, elbows, neck, that whole thing. So, so at 47, I'm really, really paying attention to that stuff now a little bit more. You know, like I said, I could still work out with everyone, but I want to be 70 on the mat. So I know it's kind of insane, but
I don't think it is.
No, I, you know what? I have great examples of great people that have been, you know, involved in martial arts and wrestling for a long time, but you just have, it's just different than when you're 20. You know, my training is different than when I was 20. Like I said before, I trained 2-3 times a day. Anybody who walked in, I was like, I'll train. Actually, you asked those three guys that I was talking about, Mazur, you know, Billy and Eric Scheffler and Rich, all saw me as a little kid. I started teaching them when I was a little kid. And Rich, especially, like I would visit him here and he would be like, Phil, go with that guy. Like he was like my dad or something, telling me to go with somebody else. And I would have to wrestle that guy, you know. Now I don't do that. I don't do that anymore. But they say, go with that guy. I was like, why? Because I time my training now.
Is there anything beyond the sixth degree?
Yeah, it's a coral belt. So it's a black and red belt. Generally, you're over 50. Been in the game, maybe black belt for over 20 years.
Wow.
So I've been a black belt for over 20 years now. And that's my next thing within the next, you know.
Is that it? That's the pinnacle?
Well, like I said, over 50. You have to have a certain number of years in and, higher ranks. So my instructor, Elson Gracie, or one of the Gracies can present it. I don't want it. I want to be like, I still want to be a black belt. I don't want to.
Why is that?
I don't know. I don't want to be, you know, the old guy on the mat with the coral belt.
It's like inevitable.
I know it's
right?
Weird, but, you know, I want to, you know, I'm happy where I am. What's cool about black belt, you don't have to worry about a belt for many years. You just train. You know, I was all.
Because that was it. It was the top, right?
The top of the basic belt. So you go white, blue, purple, brown, black. And then the black
Where's
belt.
Where's yellow fit in?
Yellow's children.
Okay.
Yeah. So, back in the day, it was your second belt. Now there's a gray belt for young, like really little kids. And then you have, you know, then you have the yellow belt, orange and green. And if you train with any green belt, watch your butt. Cause that's a kid that's been training a long time. And he's probably like the equivalent of a black belt.
So kids with green are badass.
You definitely.
What age do they go to with a green?
16. So 16, you change to a blue belt and they're not regular blue belts. Yeah, it's a kid with, you know, literally a lifetime of experience. That was me. But I didn't have the kids' belts. I just went from like white to blue. But even like when I was purple belt, I was way, you know, in some ways I was like more advanced than the black belt because I trained so long to get there. But I went from a child to, you know.
Why do you love it so much?
Because it is like an operating system. So it's a lifestyle. So it's, you know, like your performance will be disrupted if you eat something bad, if you drink something bad, if you do something that's too dangerous on your body. So you have to take care of yourself. So it is a full lifestyle, you know, and the humbling part of it is that like, I don't seek out any extra fights on the street, any conflicts. Someone just beeped at me when I was driving here and I just kept my eyes forward. I was like, you can go. I don't even want to look at them. You know, like I let conflict up. Unnecessary conflict bug me at all, you know? So that's part of the lifestyle, you know? You want to fight? What's funny is that, like, I tell everyone, I was like, especially the rough, tough young kids, I was like, you want to fight? I was like, I can get you someone about 20 minutes, they'll fight you right now. You can go in the gym, I'll lock it, you sign an agreement, you can go fight somebody. Don't do it on the street. You know, that's so I can go, you know, whatever that energy is that we need to get out on the mats, you know, whatever it is in me. Like I said, I think it's hereditary. You know, I think I came from a lot of, you know, tough people, and I'm not the tough guy in my family. My brother's definitely the tough guy.
Is he?
Know? Ricardo, yeah. Oh, yeah.
His
nickname's the animal. He has four kids. One kid, yeah.
Okay.
So, and we have nephews and cousins, and you have to see, it's like...
Is everybody fighting?
The Gracie family is big. They have hundreds of members, and we're catching up. We got a little...
Oh, shit. Is everybody a fighter in the Miglerese family?
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a bunch, yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, they're coming out of there. Because they like, oh, my, you know... My cousin or my uncle is Ricardo Miglerese. I have to, you know, I have to train. I have to do it. And, you know, then their friends train and they have their little group.
Sick.
That's awesome. It's awesome. It's, but it's all positive too. So it's not, you know, you're not in a gang. You're in there training and promoting a healthier lifestyle. But jujitsu, it goes into, you know, you're talking about entrepreneurship. I have a bunch of friends that train with me that own very large corporations and, you know, from chains of restaurants to some of the biggest law firms, they train jujitsu to do two things: burn out whatever that energy is that they don't need. Secondly, to help them with their brain. Mm-hmm. So to help them lead, to help them focus on strategy. And it's a strategic martial art. You know, you're playing chess with your body. So if you allow yourself to pull from there and paste over here in your, you know, a more professional world of wherever you are, it's huge. You know, we studied war and combat or business for, you know, quite a long time now. So there are a lot of parallels between, you know, what goes on the mat. It's a little microcosm. You know, you have a little match. Let's say someone beats you, you have to deal with disappointment, with failure, with that. Well, if you can't deal with that, just forget about business. You were talking about rejection and, you know, just forget about business, because that's all you're going to deal with. You know, I've been working in sales for over 30 years with memberships and gyms. That's how I started, as a, you know, selling gym memberships. And then I went to martial arts, and then I opened my own gym. And, you know, not only do I sell martial arts, but like our back end, like we were just talking about before, they can actually log in, see my face, and I can actually teach them how to sell a proper membership, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're not like the sharks either, you know, trying to pull salesy tricks. I was like, all that stuff is nonsense. I was like, you want to train? And all we do is just, we offer a discount very quickly. That's all I do in my gym. I make it so easy. And if they don't want the discount, they pay the regular price. If they don't sign up within a week, they just pay the regular rate, which is still affordable the next week. That's all I do. Been doing it for 21 years, making it super simple. Anybody can learn that process. But the point is, sometimes even in business, people don't focus on the sales component, the marketing component. There's so many things there that could be overwhelming. It's nice to like train a little bit. Like I said, once you train, you did a little bit, right? And trained a little bit before, right?
I never trained.
I'll just say you're a black belt now. So, you know, but, you know, even like working out too, or if you've ever done yoga, the thing that's released allows you to focus on the other stuff. So your business, your, you know, some people are more focused on academics. Maybe they want to become a professor or speaker or something like that. It's not necessarily business. I think jujitsu is definitely a good thing to do. And it's marketed for free for us via Joe Rogan, our student, Lex Friedman. I was talking about him earlier. He's one of our black belts, very large podcaster. He's awesome. He talks about jujitsu all the time, has these like major jujitsu players on there. The best marketing you can ever get. And, you know, I'm super thankful to those guys. They made it super popular. Just the art of jujitsu, not MMA necessarily, but the importance of just jujitsu.
I have two final questions. The first one is a message for somebody who's in business or is going into business. One to three things that you've learned.
Make sure it's the business that you would do for free, because you may be doing it for a while for free. So, like, I like all aspects of, you know, what I do in the martial arts. I really do. And then the ones that I don't like, I hire for, you know. And then hiring someone is a luxury. You know, you have to have the revenue to come in to hire somebody. So you may be doing things you don't like. That's the other thing. You have to do the things that you don't like as well as you, you know, do the things that you do like. in the beginning at least. And then when you have that luxury of revenue and money coming in and you can hire intelligently, the thing that you don't want to do, or that maybe you're not even good at it, pass it along, you know? So you delegate. That's huge. And, you know, to the point where I was talking about a friend of mine, he's delegating his own position right now as the CEO of his own company. He's stepping back. And that's hard for him because it was, that's the last one. And so, you know, he was saying himself, it's part ego, stepping back and exiting, you know, and then part like obsession. So, and the other thing too is like, be true to yourself. So be, you know, self-aware of what you're doing. But that self-awareness on his side, he's admitting, oh, my ego's keeping me in here. When I back away and this, the next CEO comes in, he was the founder. The next CEO comes in, I'm going to be happy they're taking my, you know, my, my company to the next level. You know, you have to know that, you know, the person that you're bringing in is helping, not hurting, you know, mm-hmm. So that, but yeah, definitely, get into a profession that you would do for free. I would do jiu-jitsu for free in 2 seconds. And I do all the time. Just, we have some bills. So I want to make sure all those things are paid. And I have families that we support that work with us, you know, but we have a really nice team of people. So it's very important that the money does come through, but it's not why I do it. If it was the reason why I did it, talk about the 90s, I didn't make anything. I just did it. You know, I went all these places. I taught privates. Now I can get $300 an hour for right now. Back in the day, it went right to the gym. I didn't even get paid for it. You know,
what's a private look like?
It could be different. It could be a full educational private. You know, someone will come in. They're lower dollar because no one's beating you down, or they're like, not, you don't have to train with them, stuff like that. So, we have these privates that, like, your first 10 to 12 lessons in jiu-jitsu is a very traditional private lesson, because Elio Gracie invented it. This way, this is the first one, second one, third one, right? Jiu-jitsu was originally taught in Brazil 100 years ago in private settings, not group settings. There weren't that many people, number one. And also, it was just, you know, a better way to do business. And it was, you know, tailored to professional. So it could look like that. And then also I have, you know, in the past, you know, I stepped back to work on the business, not in the business. Not that I didn't like it. I already did everything in the business, from sweeping the mats to selling memberships and all that stuff. And I can go back to it, and I still do. I'll sweep them. I'll do whatever it takes to keep pushing it forward. So like, me moving into working on the business and not in the business. So I had to focus on, you know, leading. I don't like to say from above because it's a team, but I had to lead the team. And if I didn't do that, I had multiple studios, so that would suffer. But I pulled away from teaching private lessons. So since I pulled away, if anybody wanted one, I was like, yeah, give me $1,000 an hour and I'll do it. You know, and I had two people actually do it, but that's a sparring private. So that's me. We shake hands. I don't know you from anyone. We're going to go, you know, we're going to go for a full hour. So two people took me up on it in 20 years. And who's going to pay $1,000 an hour?
You're going to have a lot of bread.
So one guy, he was just so gung-ho to do it. And another guy, like, he came in, he paid his money. I was like, wow, I don't know. You know, I hope he enjoys this one, you know? And I started like, and he was a brown belt. He was good. And I started wrestling with him, and hit the wrestling side of it. It was a sparring private. Lasted, I tired the guy out in 7 minutes. He was just dead. He was like, all right, let's do some moves. So he did moves. And then everybody prepaid too. And then the next guy, you know, he wired in. I got the money, you know, and I waited for him for like 3 hours. Never showed up.
Wow.
Yeah. So
why didn't he show up? He just
didn't
care.
No idea. I have no clue. I don't know. This is so long ago. I never even told this story. It's kind of funny.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting.
So
the last question is, what's a message for law enforcement?
I'm saying, consider it. Consider jiu-jitsu, consider defensive tactics, especially when it's taught by someone that's not expecting anything but somebody showing up so they can actually do it. Meaning, I know a lot of officers go out of their way and don't get paid to share jiu-jitsu and the combatives that are street ready. And sometimes people don't show to class, you know? So my recommendation is show up to class, whether you're better than everyone or, you know, just starting. And I, like I said, I feel like there's the ego thing, because I feel like when you put somebody out in the street, they should have a certain level of toughness. all that. And then when you don't feel like you are, or you have to prove it, how tough you are on a mat with, you know, some people who may really be super tough, drop it all, drop the egos, you know, just get in there, do it. It'll save your life. Maybe something that you learn and your experience on the mat that you pass along to a friend that's on the job could save their life. And I have a folder. I've been teaching law enforcement technically since I was 16 years old. So that's when my uncle brought me into the Lawrence Police Department and showed some moves. From that point to now, I have a folder of thank yous from law enforcement. Thank you so much for the this move, that move, this thinking, that thinking, whatever it is. I keep them and I look through them. And one of the most important ones was two big ones. One was for wellness, mental health. So he got in there. He made jiu-jitsu a part of his world. He trained in a gym, like a regular jiu-jitsu gym, and it changed his whole mentality. You know, he wasn't going on down the right path with his mind. And it was getting dangerous at that point. And he started training and changed his whole body chemistry, he said. It's a huge one. The second one was FBI agent that I remember teaching because they were very, you know, they're about 100. He was a 120-something pound male. He was very interested in techniques. And he was out on the job one day, and the guy, you know, like when the FBI do their work, they know who they're after. They know exactly where they're going to be. They know exactly where they're going to pick them up. You know, that's the advantage of, you know, that job. You know, you're who you're going with. You know, you've been looking at them on a piece of paper on a computer for months, right? And so they went to the destination. They were in the house. Couldn't find them. They were like, where, you know. Guy jumps out of a closet or something, gets on the little guy, puts him on his butt, starts hitting him with the elbow. Federal agent is down on his back. Partners are looking for him around the facility. He was able to maneuver and hold himself in what's called the half guard, not even a full guard, or he wasn't able to get up. He was just holding for dear life in the right places so he wouldn't get hurt. He wrote me a 3-page letter of the importance of that. He's going to continue training outside, you know. And without it, if he was on his own without partners, there's no way he could have survived that situation. No way. So he was able to control just enough to be vocal. Hey, I'm here. You know, couldn't get to any other device to call. If you take a hand away, you get grounded. And the guy was like double his weight or more, you know, but he was able to hold. And he was like, thank God for jiu-jitsu because it was designed for a smaller person against a bigger person. I don't know any other martial art that does that. I really don't. I mean, you could be a little guy punching a big guy. And I say best of luck with that because when they return fire, you're going to feel the difference. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in striking. I know. You know, you get hit by a bigger human, you're like, wow. So,
especially if they know how to hit, right?
Yeah. And then when you're in a job where you need to skillfully subdue somebody, you know, you need the right moves, you know, and you need to understand your body weight and, you know, just how to even help your partners to doing partner drills properly. You don't get in the way of your partner, you know, or arresting someone or keeping it even safe for the person on bottom. So that's what I said. Like, consider jiu-jitsu if it's offered anywhere at your department or, you know, consider it. You know, I highly recommend it.
Yeah. And I beg you to go and take it because I just don't to this day understand. I think our top priority is self-preservation and the preservation of life. Or the lives of others, and the thought that you're so lackadaisical with it, take it so not seriously, is flabbergasting to me. And you know what? I mean, maybe I'm speaking to myself at a younger age as well, but it wasn't what it is now. And it's so available, it's so normal. And there are a lot more cops taking it on their own time and dime than ever before. And I actually believe that. Majority of them are females.
Well, here's the other thing about it. It's not just law enforcement that's training. Somebody you may pull over or, you know, have to take down is also training.
Right.
That's the problem. Bad guys are, you know, they're getting the right equipment.
For sure. Well, Phil, where can people find you? What are you trying to promote? Anything like that?
Right now, I'm at my gym now, Balance Studios.
Where's that?
In Fishtown.
You have Instagram, your gyms.
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram. It's under Jiu-Jitsu Matrix. So that's my nickname growing up. And my school is Balance Studio. So on Instagram, it's at Balance MMA.
You guys do a lot of work with law enforcement?
We do, yeah. So we'll have things once or twice a year at the gym. So if you ever want to know about that, you can follow, like I said, the Balance.
If a cop wants to come and take training with you guys, what should he or she do?
Just call. Yeah, yeah. Our basics program, it's 90% of the law enforcement program. So they're actually getting the same thing. That the only thing that would be different would be the gun retention.
How long do you think somebody has to go through a program with you guys before they feel a little more
comfortable? 6 months. Yeah,
more or less. So commit to 6 months, have a lifetime of skills.
I think so, yeah. Or just the base level that you would need in a real encounter. So
amazing. You could take this and just implant this into police academies,
yeah,
and fix so many fucking problems, save so many lives. Wild.
Yeah, it is.
6 months. It's a blast having you here. It was a really good podcast.
I truly appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Hey guys, check out our upcoming training at streetcop.com. Don't forget, we have 50 instructors nationally teaching a variety of topics. These are the best classes you're going to experience in your career. We make sure of it. You're going to love it. I guarantee you, you're going to be thankful that you went. Check us out at streetcop.com for all upcoming classes in your area.